pretty serious here for 3 weeks, but in the middle of that will be the hoedown. So today is the first session, and they're going to be all about, it's going to all be about growing in faith. And it's kind of a takeoff of a chapter in one of my books that's called, the book is called The Fence of Salvation. And it's about Hebrew and Aramaic word studies and word pictures. So I'm not going to be talking about the word pictures, but what faith is and how we can grow it. And so I want you to turn to Romans chapter 1, first of all. I think faith is a topic, our series this year is about walking in victory. And faith is something that seems to be sort of an elusive concept. Do you agree?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But like, you think you're going to have an understanding of it, and then it just kind of slips through your fingers. And you go, well, I thought I knew a lot about faith, but boy, I don't know. Why are my prayers not being answered? Why do I see around me, all kinds of things going on where it doesn't seem like there is the answer? So those are some of the questions we're going to talk about and really get into. And I want to read Romans 1 and verse 16 to start out with here. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God. It's the what?
Power.
I said that in the manifestations.
Yeah,
the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it, in the gospel, is the righteousness of God. The righteousness of God is revealed from what?
Faith to faith.
Faith to faith. And as it is written, the righteous or the just shall live by faith. So this idea that righteousness is revealed from faith to faith. Wow. I thought when you got born again, you just got faith. Well, this seems to indicate here, and there's a number of ways you can translate this. The righteousness of God is revealed from the beginning of faith to the end of faith. So from that exact moment that we got born again, we believed, right? We believed that God raised Jesus from the dead. And that's the beginning of faith. But then our whole lives is this journey of continuing faith. And it's not a straight line up. Like, oh, there's the mountain, I'm going up it. It's not like that. It's like this. But the gist of it is that you're going up the mountain. Because if you take up just a second here and you look back on your life from the moment you got born again until now, you can see how much that you have believed. But now the greatest part is that until our dying breath, we're going to be continuing to grow in faith. So it's from the beginning of faith to the end of faith. As it is written, the just, are we just?
Yes.
Shall live by faith. So we live by faith. So it's a really important concept to understand and to really grasp onto. So now look over at Romans 10. Because this is the section where if we do these things, we will get born again. But we're going to start back in verse 8. It says, what does it say? The word is near you, in your mouth, and in your heart. That is the word of faith that we proclaim or preach. Because if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, and you believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. All right. See there, it says that the word is near you. It's in your mouth, and it's in your heart. And that's the word of So we did this. We said, yes, God raised Jesus from the dead. And we believe that, right? And we confess with our mouth that Jesus was Lord. That's the point of the beginning of faith. And at that point, you have the word of faith. Because this is an ongoing process of confessing with your mouth the Lord Jesus and believing in your heart. So there's two elements to faith, and that's what I wanted you to see, is a mouth and heart. And all of faith is wrapped up in what we do with our mouths and what we do with our, in our heart. So go on and see what it says after that in verse 10. For with the heart one believes and is justified, and with the mouth one confesses and is saved. Saved, salvation is not just something that happened the moment you got born again. It's ongoing. We're always being saved. It just means to have life, have spiritual life. And that's why it's tied together with faith, because it takes faith to have it happen, but it issues in we will be saved. We are being saved. We're going to be saved. For the scripture says, everyone who believes in him will not be put to shame. There's a lot of different quotations of this verse. It's from Isaiah 28:16, if you want to go look it up. One translation says, everyone who believes in who?
Jesus
Christ,
yeah.
Believes on him will not panic, will not be disturbed. Yeah, really. So just think for a moment about this idea that there's these two elements, your mouth and your heart. And I want to read to you a quotation by a famous preacher named Charles Spurgeon. It's really, really good. So just listen for a second. Because the faith that saves is not believing certain truths, nor even believing that Jesus is a Savior. That's the beginning, right? But it is resting on him, depending on him, lying with all your weight on Christ as the foundation of your hope. Or your faith. Believe that he can save you. Believe that he will save you. At any rate, leave the whole matter of your salvation or your life with him in unquestioning confidence. Depend upon him without fear as to your present and eternal salvation. But this is the faith which makes whole our soul. It's depending on him, depending on God as our foundation with unquestioning confidence. So that just led me to okay, well, what's confidence then? How do I get it? I mean, that song about confidence is just amazing because it's about how we can slay all the giants in our life, you know, and Marty's been teaching about that for the last four or five weeks. And this is kind of a continuation of it, where it's not necessarily a specific giant, but all the giants. So whatever our giants are, we can slay them with confidence. So they're like, okay, I need to know what confidence is. All right, there's two words for trust and confidence. And in Hebrew, they are spelled kasah, which is C-H-A-S-A-H. And then the second one is batach, B-A-T-A-C-H. So it's really important to understand these two words because they give us keys to understanding how we begin to trust. The first word, kasah, you can turn to Psalm 18. It has an action, and it means to flee for refuge. to run someplace. And lots of times in the Psalms, David explains it as trust means to, like, flee for refuge under his wings, or under the rock, or under the shelter of his arms. That's why that song about the God who stays is so beautiful, because he's got his arms open like this, and all we got to do is run into them. He's the God who's always faithful and who always knows where the faith is and how to get it. So what we got to do is to run into those arms. So flee for refuge. Look at verse 1 of Psalm 18. I love you, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge. I flee for refuge. That's the word chesed. My shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. So you can just take this one verse right here and start putting it in your mouth. The Lord is my rock. He's my fortress. He's my deliverer. I can run to him. Just make it personal. We're going to talk the next session a lot more about how to pray the scriptures and how to say with your mouth. But I just want to see that both of these things, your mouth and your heart, are wrapped up in trusting. Okay. If you wanted to have a definition for that word, it's to recognize our need for God's love and support, and then go to him. You recognize you have a need, and then you go to him. An example, I was just visiting my grandchildren in North Carolina, and they are always doing really great, but all of a sudden, you know, Maddie falls off her bicycle. She's like tearing around on this bicycle on a two-wheeler, and then she's just like down on the ground. And, oh my gosh, who does she run to? Her daddy. Yeah. He goes barreling in the house. Dude! And he's got his arms open. Oh honey, what happened? You know, and he scoops her up. She lays her head down and it's like, okay, I'm okay now. And if it's serious, then he can take care of her. But the first idea that she has in her heart is this childlike thing of, I'm going to go to my daddy. I'm going to go run there. I don't know what happened. I don't know why it happened. I don't know anything about it, but I'm going to run there. That's what we need to do first, is just run to God. Flee there. Go into his open arms. And God is love, even more than our earthly parents are. So that's why we run to him. Because he's the God who's faithful. He's the God of love. So whatever our need is, this is the starting place. Okay, now the second word, batak, it has an action that means to cling, like hold on tight to something. It's an assurance or belief in the goodwill of someone else. Now, question. Do we believe that God is love?
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Do you?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Then, because God is love, you can have confidence. You can have an assurance. The confidence part is the assurance that no matter what the situation is, God will be there for us. So now, I got a great example for you. It's in Daniel. It's just an exciting record about what happened to Daniel right at the beginning of his time in Babylon. So we're going to read a little bit of it. Daniel chapter 2. Another action that has to do with confidence is where you throw down on your face. Like, an action tells what's in your heart, okay? If I'm clinging, or I'm clinging to something, I also can just fall down on my face and go, oh man, this situation is too big for me. I gotta do something. Wow. You just go down on your knees, down on your face, and say, to acknowledge that there is someone who is bigger than you, who has the answer. So this is what Daniel did. Daniel chapter 2, and like I said, this was in the very early time when Daniel and his friends Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they had come to Babylon, and they were put into the group of the wise men, but they hadn't proved themselves yet. So, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. And now we're going to see that actually Daniel was not there at that moment, although he was included in this group. So they came in and they stood before the king. And the king said to them, get this, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. So the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. They said, well, if you tell us the dream, we'll tell you what it was. If we have to make up something, we'll tell you what it was. And the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, well, sorry, guys. The word for me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn from limb to limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive gifts from me and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation. Whoa! And they're going already to start freaking out. Because they don't know what the dream is. So how can they tell what the interpretation is? So they answered a second time in verse 7. Well, maybe let the king tell his servants what the dream is, and we will show its interpretation. The king said, answered, I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time, because you see that the word from me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the times change. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I will know that you can show me its interpretation. So at that point, all the wise men, the Chaldeans, the sorcerers, they are really totally freaking out. Because this has become now not just a question of, well, let's make up something, but we're going to die. This is a life and death thing. He was not kidding. This is at the very, very beginning of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, and he's proven himself as to be this absolute dictator, basically. And like, I get rid of all you guys. I don't care. A whole bunch more will follow after you. He didn't have any sympathy for any of it. He just said, I want to know what this dream meant and what the interpretation is. So, okay, let's see. Go down to, where are we here? Let's go down to verse 13. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed. And they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. And then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. And he asked him, he said, he declared to Arioch, why is the decree of the king so urgent? So he didn't really know what the problem was, but he and his friends were being included in this group of wise men. So Daniel, verse 16, he went in and he requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. Right here, from the very beginning, you see that Daniel had confidence.
Mm-hmm.
He knew that if he went to God, God would tell him what the answer was. And so he goes straight to the king. He said, all I need is a little time, and I will tell you what it was. And under his breath, he's probably going, okay, and if he doesn't tell me, you know what? And the worst case is, we're all going to die. But he laid it on the line. See? So, again, mouth, right? So his faith was being echoed by his mouth. All right. Now, keep going here. Verse 17. Here's where there's a really, really big key. Then Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. That's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. His companions. And he told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of God. So the very first thing he does is he goes to his house, he basically shuts the door, and does not go into the what if scenario or freaking out like the other wise men do. He goes in his house, he shuts the door, and then he tells his companions, I need you to pray with me. And so that together they pray. And then, verse 19, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. And he says in verse 21 there, he changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness. And the light dwells with him. So not only is God love, but he's also light. And because he is light, he can reveal things that are hidden. So, we're not going to read the rest of the story, but Daniel gets the vision of the dream, which is a statue that has gold on his head, and then silver on his chest, and bronze here, and then iron. And it's actually, the interpretation is the unfolding of history from that point until the coming of the kingdom of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. It's this incredible unfolding of what was going to happen not only during Nebuchadnezzar's time, but in each succeeding empire. Oh. God gave that dream to Nebuchadnezzar. But then Daniel was there to be the one to interpret it and to really unfold it to them. And that dream and the interpretation of it has stood from that point, which, you know, thousands of years ago until today. And we are going to see the fulfillment of it. Isn't that amazing? So God is the one who reveals mysteries. Okay. So the key in there to remember is that When you go down on your face and you go down on your knees and you shut out all the distractions around you, that's when God can reveal the mysteries and the hidden things. And that's why it says anyone who believes on him is not going to be disturbed or panicked. Why? Because if you really are believing, see, you're fleeing for refuge, but then you're building a confidence that God will answer your prayer. And don't care how long it's going to take. But when it's a life and death situation, he comes through pretty fast. So that's really neat, huh? Okay, one more example is Remember the verse in Proverbs chapter 3 about trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not to your own understanding. Okay, I have another example about Elijah where it's about not leaning to your own understanding. You can look at 1 Kings 19. Elijah, 1 Kings 19. Elijah had just had this incredible miracle with the, on Mount Carmel, where he killed all the prophets of Baal. Fire came down from heaven, burned up the ox and the water and everything. And meantime, all the prophets of Baal were cutting themselves and screaming and crying, and nothing happened, right? But God came through with fire and also sent rain. But he killed all the prophets of Baal. It was an incredible victory. I've been on the top of Mount Carmel, too, and went down on that valley. I mean, it was an amazing, amazing, amazing story. But Elijah, in chapter 19, it says, Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the swords. And Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, well, so may the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as one of them by this time tomorrow. I mean, she was furiously mad, right? Okay. But it says, verse 3, then he was afraid. And he arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. So what we're seeing here is not even so much that Elijah was afraid, although it says that he was here. But all this time, up until then, Jezebel's been threatening him, and she's killed a lot of other prophets, and Elijah did not bow one iota and until this climax happened on the top of Mount Carmel, where he actually killed all the prophets. You would have thought, he'd be like, I don't care what she says. That's not going to happen, but what happens is that Elijah goes into a big, giant pity party, and he's really upset, not so much about Jezebel chasing him, as he thought that since this great miracle had happened on the top of Mount Carmel, that all Israel should have changed and started worshiping God again and really just cut off the whole thing with Baal. And they didn't. And so he got really, really, really discouraged. But talk about a giant. He's like, all my life I've been a prophet for you, God, and here, look at what we did, and now what? It hasn't changed a thing. That's kind of what his attitude was. All right, go down to verse 4. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree, and he asked that he might die, saying, it is enough now, O Lord. Take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers. And he lay down and he slept under a broom tree. And behold, an angel touched him and said to him, arise and eat. And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. And he ate and drank and lay down again. I'm like, oh, so what? An angel came and ate. I don't care. I want to die. I don't care anymore about anything anymore. This is serious stuff. And if you've ever gotten to the place where the discouragement is so overwhelming, then you know exactly what Elijah was going through. And even a small taste of it, we know what he was going through. Because when you are discouraged and you go onto this pity party thing, then you cannot see. It's like putting blinders on your face. You cannot see what's on the side of it. All you can see is how you feel and how you think and what's going on. You go over and over and over and over it of how bad everything is. Well, The good news is that Elisha had fled, right? And he ends up going, verse 7, the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, "Okay, get going, arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you." And he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mount of God. So he knew enough that I got to go be in God's presence, in spite of his discouragement. But let's read the story still. There he came to a cave and lodged in it. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, this is what he said. "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts." He's talking to God, right? He's saying, "I am very jealous of the Lord. For the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." So here, that's how we know it was a pity party. "I'm the only one left." I mean, he's really going on and on and on about the deceit. Because he says it again later, too. So God tells him to go out and stand on the mountain. And he sends the earthquake and the fire and storm and everything to pass by. And then he whispers to Elijah in a still, small voice. Verse 13. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and he went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. He was like, "Okay, I hear you. I do hear you, but it hasn't changed a thing." So he wraps himself in his cloak and he goes out there and the sun goes, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he says it again. "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. For the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I, only am left. And they seek my life to take it away." So now God finally just goes, "Okay, that's enough of that stuff. I'm going to tell you what the truth is here." The Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria, and Jehu the son of Nimshi you shall anoint to be king over Israel, and Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel-Mehoah you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. And the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu put to death, and the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha put to death." And now the key verse. "Yet I will leave, I have left, 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." So God not only tells Elijah what to do, go anoint all these guys, and especially go pick out Elisha to follow you. But he tells him, the answer to your pity party is that you are not the only one left. I have at least 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. So get going! Just cut it out already! Stop believing the lie! You are not alone. See, discouragement, really, that's the focus. It's I only, I. Like I said, there's blinders like this, right? And we can't see. So we can't go have confidence. Because all we're doing is looking at ourselves. At that point, let's see. Verse 19, so he departed and he found Elisha. At that point, from that point on, Elisha agrees to follow him And Elijah is never alone again in his whole life. Elisha is his companion, his servant. They go back, they teach the school of the prophets again. They go do all this stuff where they anoint all these guys. And Elisha sticks by him the whole rest of his life. Isn't that a cool answer that God gave to Elijah? It's like he really understood his heart. He was saying, okay, I get it. You're not going to have to be alone anymore. All this time, Elijah had done all these things standing by himself, which thankfully we don't have to do because we have our whole family everywhere all the time. But that doesn't prevent us sometimes from feeling like we're alone. Right? So, we've got to go over what we learned, right? The word of faith comes in your mouth and your heart. And when you realize that God really loves you, then you can run to Him. And just like Daniel, confronted with a really life and death situation, you fall down on your knees. But then we ask our brothers and sisters to pray with us for God to have mercy and wait, which is something we're all going to be talking about later too, until you hear the answer, until you get the dream and the interpretation. And then the last thing is, in order to slay the giant of discouragement and have confidence, then you have to identify where the lie is. It's not, I only am loved. I am not alone. In Hebrews 13, it talks about how God said, I will never leave you. I will absolutely never leave you nor forsake you. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that later too, but it means my hands will not relax hold of you. I will always be standing here with my arms open saying, run to me! Come to me. I will show you. I will be there for you. And that's why we can have confidence. So, the next time we're going to be talking about how faith and hope are intertwined. But I wanted to just read you the beginning of another song that we're also going to sing next time. It's called The God of All My Days. It's by Casting Crowns. And at the beginning, he says, I came to you with my heart in pieces and found the God with healing in his hands. I turned to you, put everything else behind me, and found the God who makes all things new. I looked to you, drowning in my questions, and found the God of all wisdom. And I trusted you, clinging onto it, and stepped out on the ocean. You caught my hand among the waves because you're the God of all my days. Each step I take, you make a way, and I will give you all my praise. My seasons change, but you stay the same. You're the God of all my days. So I encourage you to go listen to that song before the next time that we meet, and really think about these things, like what is the giant that you are facing, and how is it that I can get my mouth and my heart coordinated here to be able to really cling onto God's promises in an area where I need them. I've had a situation over the last few weeks where I had a really severe flu and cold. And it was really tough getting over it, and still can hear just a tiny bit of it, but I've been so thankful because it was a process of doing what I'm talking about, of just like having to keep running to it and having to keep reiterating the promises over and over again. Jesus Christ paid the price for my healing. Amen. And I am not alone. I'm not alone fighting this battle. I'm not alone in terms of, my family too. So last week when I was in Denver, we had a time with Catalina and Dan Connell, where we sat down and we prayed about all number of things. And it was so uplifting. It really helped me turn the corner of the whole thing. Where you can't just like necessarily pinpoint or say, no, I have faith. But this growing in faith is something that it happens. And we're not even sure exactly how it does happen, but we are growing. Or you realize God protected me from an incredible thing. There's so many testimonies about it. Anyway, I love you. I encourage you to think about this topic in the coming weeks. All right? God bless you.